Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to come in this hour from our quick conversations about a lot of news to update or we didn't get to earlier in the week. Let's start, as we often do, with a legislative update during our 2018 session. This week at the State House, lawmakers in the Iowa Senate passed a bill that would allow the Iowa Farm Bureau to offer a health plan not subject to the rules of the Affordable Care Act. Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell covers the State House. As we know, she joins me now. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Let's talk about this health care plan. What's behind it?
Well, I think what's behind it is the situation with the individual marketplace for people who don't have insurance through their employer or through government assistance. This is a pretty big problem right now for a number of Iowans. And this is being proposed as one solution. It won't be insurance. They're calling it a health benefit plan. The Farm Bureau will offer it to members. Anyone can become a Farm Bureau member if they want to take advantage of this. But it will not be regulated by the insurance commissioner. And it will not, as you just said, it will not be subject to the rules of the Affordable Care Act. So things like covering pre-existing conditions, co-pays, all kinds of things will be in some ways, well, by one estimate, the premiums will be 30% to 40% less than premiums in the individual marketplace, but the coverage will be less. And one of the complaints about this, or one of the concerns about it, is that it's essentially will attract healthy people who don't have a lot of medical problems, and that will just exacerbate the problems in the individual marketplace. If healthy people leave, then that makes the system even more trouble.
So intended or not, it sort of further undermines the marketplace of the ACA.
Yes, and but it passed by a really wide margin. Democrats waged a spirited battle against it on the floor of the Senate, but at the same time, all of these, many of these senators, if not all of them, have constituents who are having trouble getting health insurance. Mm-hmm. And this includes, self-employed farmers. And so many people stood up and said, we have to do this for our constituents.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, a number of things yet to get to. Let me ask you about education. A new bill that says Iowa teachers don't have to take tests to get their teaching license, something like that?
A particular test that was required as part of education reform back in 2013. This was part of Governor Branstad's agenda. There were a number of things passed that year. And it's a subject matter test that when you come out of a teacher preparation program, you have to score at a certain percentile in order to get your teacher's license. And the main argument against this test that was presented in the House debate was a problem attracting teachers in rural areas and other areas. So we heard stories of superintendents saying that they had a great candidate, somebody who really wanted to teach for them, they really wanted to hire, but they did not score a high enough score so they couldn't become licensed teachers. Mm. So you can probably just imagine the kind of debate on the floor of the House of not wanting to, the expression was used, dumb down, not to dumb down the teaching profession.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that looks like it has enough support to go further?
Well, it's going over to the Senate, and we'll see what happens there.
Another interesting aspect of legislation going on, a conversation about religious freedom on campus. This stems from a University of Iowa incident, a group losing its certification after denying a gay student a leadership role. Give us some background and what's being proposed here.
Well, this bill was actually proposed before that issue broke out on the University of Iowa campus. And it's a conservative issue across the country, actually. And it pits, religious freedom against civil rights. It's one of two religious freedom bills that the legislature has considered this year. The other one having to do with the ability of people to not provide services for gay and lesbian couples. And so the religious freedom issue is a big issue for many conservatives. And the interesting thing about both of those bills, to me, was the strong opposition that came from the business community, both with the bill to let businesses say they won't serve gay and lesbian couples, and then this bill that said campus groups should be able to put whoever they want into mm-hmm. leadership positions. In both instances, the business community was very strongly opposed. On this campus one that was debated this past week, the Meredith Corporation had a spokesman there, and the Meredith, you know, has just merged with Time Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a position to bring a new professional people into Iowa, and they say bills like this make Iowa look like an unwelcoming place.
And so with the business community opposition here, does it look like it will go further?
Well, the earlier religious freedom bill was in the Senate. This one's in the House. So we'll see whether either one mm-hmm. of them fly.
The Department of Human Services Director Jerry Foxhoven faces a confirmation vote, we heard this week. He's been serving in the role since June amid the highly controversial switch over to the privately managed Medicaid in the state. This confirmation isn't a given. Why?
There's just tremendous opposition. Actually, legislators of both parties hear complaints from their constituents, from providers who are not getting paid on time, and from patients who are being denied service. And the Jerry Foxhoven confirmation was brought up one evening this week, and the Democrats asked to defer on it. We thought we were going to get the debate. The Democrats broke for a caucus and then came back and deferred on it. So they're still, I'm sure, strategizing just how serious they are about bringing him down, how his replacement would make a difference with Medicaid privatization. But it is still pending. That the confirmations have to be approved by April 15th, so they have a while to consternate about that.
Joyce, but before we let you go, a little later today there'll be what is called a revenue estimating conference. What is it? Why is it important?
Well, that's the three-member panel that gets together periodically and reads the tea leaves, studies the economic news, and makes projections about how much money is going to be collected in taxes for the legislature to spend.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, their estimates have been off. Recently, they've said we're expecting this much money. The budget is built on that much money, and then that much money doesn't come in. So
by tens of millions of dollars, yes.
By millions of dollars, and so they're at their March meeting. They will update their estimates for tax receipts for this fiscal year, the one that ends in June, and then for next fiscal year, and then that's what the legislature will have to build their budget on for next fiscal year. This year, it's especially critical because the legislature is in the process of cutting this year's budget because of shortfalls in revenue. So whatever they say today will determine, I mean, if things have really picked up, then they might not have to cut this year's budget. If they've fallen even more, they may have to cut this year's budget even more than they thought. So there's a lot hanging on this estimate today.
Okay, Joyce, we'll let you get back to it. Keeping track of all that's happening at the State House, Joyce Russell, IPR State House correspondent. Joyce and I will be devoting the entire hour this coming Monday to lawmakers addressing mental health issues. Joyce, I look forward to that.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's keep with some legislative developments here in Iowa. Well, if you listened to River on Monday, you remember we talked about an omnibus energy bill that was being considered at the State House. That bill passed in the Iowa Senate Tuesday evening. The Iowa Senate also passed a bill that would require 5 of 7 members of the justices of the Iowa Supreme Court, a supermajority, to vote to deem an Iowa law unconstitutional. Let's talk about these developments with Bill Petrosky, state government reporter with the Des Moines Register. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk about these two developments, the omnibus energy bill, first of all. What are the most controversial parts of it?
Oh, boy. You could probably find a long list of controversial things here, but essentially what the biggest thing I think is that it would change the situation in terms of energy efficiency and allow people to opt out of this kind of thing, and it would change the way that overall regulation is done. It would clarify the jurisdiction of the Iowa Utilities Board over non-rate regulated utilities and reduce regulatory inefficiencies, create opt-out program for customers who don't want to participate in the energy efficiency initiatives, these quote-unquote demand response incentive programs, ensure that the cost of gas and electricity are equally shared among customers, help extend natural gas service to underserved communities, and provide joint financing for natural gas extensions by cities and counties. That's kind of the short explanation by the Republicans, but the Democrats say, hey, what this would really do is this would just be a terrible thing for Iowa consumers. They say that 20,000 jobs would be lost. They estimate the actual cost of energy for Iowans would be raised by $400 to $500 million a year, and they say they call it one of the dumbest bills this session. So it's a very, very controversial.
And I see in your reporting, Bill, that a long list of groups and businesses: Google, Facebook, Apple, Iowa pork producers. They all oppose it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It the list just goes on and on, as well as the usual groups that you would expect to be opposed with, like the Sierra Club, the Iowa Environmental Council, Environmental Law and Policy Center, CCI, Nature Conservancy, those kinds of groups. And to a certain extent, when you look at how hard that the state of Iowa has worked to recruit businesses like Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and how much attention the legislature pays to the Iowa groups like the Iowa pork producers, you kind of wonder why they are doing it. But the Republicans say, hey, we really need to take a comprehensive look at Iowa's energy policy, the way that we regulate our utilities, and they think that this is something that needs to be changed.
Mm-hmm. With all the opposition you mentioned, do you have a sense of whether it has enough support to become law?
Well, the bill now goes over to the House, and what I've been told is that the House is going to seriously look at adopting some changes in the way that Iowa regulates its utilities, but it's not going to be exactly this type of a bill. But yes, they are going to seriously look at making some changes, but probably not on exactly the way that the Senate has done it.
Okay, let's talk about some other business in the Iowa Senate. Passing a bill that would require 5 of 7 justices of the Iowa Supreme Court to vote to hold an Iowa law unconstitutional. Currently, 4 of 7, a simple majority. Currently, this change would make it a supermajority, 5 of 7. Explain why Republicans are pushing for this change.
Well, this was just a fascinating debate you had. The two of the key players on this were Senator Julian Garrett, who's a lawyer, and on the other side was Senator Todd Bowman from Maquoketa, who's a high school government teacher. And it would be a great thing for a high school civics class to listen to this debate, because what Senator Garrett was saying is, hey, you know, we have this situation in the state of Iowa where the House and Senate, by large majorities, can approve a bill, and then the governor signs it, and then it gets sent through the court system, and just 4 people can rule on one side and 3 on the other side, and a bill can be declared unconstitutional, undoing everything that the legislature has done. And of course, the other side is, hey, this is the reason why we have separate branches of government, so that we can look at things differently, and that you do have these people who are trained jurists who can look at things strictly from a legal perspective, whereas the legislature may be looking at things from more of what is the most popular kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about separation of power in the 3 branches of government, in just looking at this initially, it seems like, Bill, can the legislative branch, in effect, unilaterally just weaken the judicial branch in this way? Because that's what it would be, right? You set the bar higher for them to declare a law unconstitutional, and you're weakening them, right?
That's exactly right. And what the legislators say is that if you look at the Iowa Constitution, there is language in there that lets them pass this type of a law. But, of course, this type of a law would have to be reviewed by the Iowa Supreme Court. And what the Democrats say is, hey, guess what? You darn well better believe that the Iowa Supreme Court is going to rule that this law is unconstitutional. So,
and then that would still be undercurrent. Four justices would take the day, right?
That's exactly right. And one of the things that came up here was people were saying, you know, what court cases were there that that you could cite where you would want to change these kinds of things? And Senator Garrett brought up a case of Isaiah Sweet. You may be familiar with this. This would involve somebody who was underage who committed a couple of murders. And this the Supreme Court made a ruling in this case that was pretty controversial. But if you really look at this, I think the bottom line is that there's still a lot of residual concern by social conservative groups. The people who are really strongly in support of this bill are groups like the Faith and Freedom, Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, Concerned Women for America, and I know an earlier version of this bill, the Family Leader was there. And of course, there's still, I think, a tremendous amount of resentment since the Varnum decision, the decision on same-sex marriage here in Iowa, and as you're aware, there's also some significant bills pending in the Iowa legislature, particularly the fetal heartbeat bill, and if that in fact were to pass, I think there's a concern that by social conservatives that would be thrown out mm-hmm. on the grounds that it was unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if you look at the legal groups that are in support of this, or who are very strongly opposed to it, includes the Iowa State Bar Association, Iowa Association for Justice, the Iowa Academy of Trial Lawyers. So the legal groups are very strongly opposed to this.
Mm-hmm. So this proposal to move to a supermajority rather than a simple majority also comes against the backdrop of Iowa lawmakers proposing slashing Iowa's judiciary branch's budget, right? And also
that's absolutely right.
And docking,
that's absolutely right.
Docking the pay of the chief judges for barring guns from county courthouses. So there's a lot of baggage here, as we say, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Democrats point out. And in all honesty, there was a lot of hard feelings on partisanship going back and forth in the legislature this week. And this bill is a classic example of that type of thing.
Okay, Bill. Before we go, what awaits this bill in the House?
This bill goes to the House, and action has to be taken on this bill next week. This bill is definitely a live round, and we'll see next week just what happens to it.
We're glad you're there to tell us about it. Bill Petrowski, state government reporter for the Des Moines Register. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you very much, Ben. Always good talking with you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. More news to discuss about Iowa's Supreme Court. On Tuesday of this week, the Iowa Supreme Court heard arguments in a case in which two women are suing a church in Pella, Iowa, for failing to supervise a pastor who sexually exploited them. It also heard a case regarding a juvenile conviction. Iowa Public Radio's Katerina Sestarek is following these stories. She joins me now. Hi, Katerina.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk about the case in Pella. Tell me about it.
So Valerie and Ann Banstra, who are two sisters-in-law and their husbands, are suing the Covenant Reformed Church, and that's in Pella. They were sexually abused by a pastor a few years ago, and that pastor was convicted on 4 counts of sexual exploitation by a counselor. And now the women are suing the church. A Marion County District Court judge threw out their lawsuit, and so they're asking the Supreme Court to let them continue this lawsuit. They're suing the Church Board of Elders, which is 16 men who oversee the church, for failing to supervise that pastor. They say that the elders allowed the pastor to counsel women in a locked room, and they didn't really look into it, despite clergy sexual abuse being a pretty common issue. They're also suing for defamation. They're saying that the elders publicly accused them of committing adultery. And the elders also asked the women to confess their what they called sins before the board of elders, and also told the women that bringing a lawsuit would be a sin. The women, of course, say that they are victims of clergy sexual abuse, and therefore they haven't sinned and have nothing to confess.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what the attorney for the church is saying in the face of that.
So that attorney is saying that the actions by the elders were related to their religious beliefs, so the court can't really get involved. That lawyer says that it would go against the Religious Freedom Clause of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. He says ultimately this is a disagreement over religious beliefs surrounding sin, repentance, and forgiveness, and interpretation of the Bible, and so the court should not get involved.
Hmm. Okay. Iowa's High Court also hearing an appeal this week about a juvenile conviction. Tell us about that.
That's the case of the state of Iowa versus Keon Harrison. He was convicted related to a murder that happened in 2014 when he was 17 years old. And so he was convicted of first-degree murder with a sentence of life in prison with possibility of parole. So he was found to have participated in a robbery. Harrison's lawyer says there was no evidence that Harrison had a gun or used a gun. They're sort of saying that the person, Harrison's partner in that robbery, is the one who likely committed the murder. The victim ended up dying. So the reason it became a first-degree murder charge is because of this felony murder rule, and that says that if someone's killed during the commission of a felony, which in this case would be a robbery, you can be charged with first-degree murder even if you weren't premeditating that murder, which is a condition of other first-degree murder cases. So Harrison's lawyer is saying that this rule should not be applied to juveniles because he says that requires foresight. You have to be able to foresee that someone might get killed in that type of a situation. And he's saying that juveniles just don't have that same foresight and impulse control that can be expected of adults because their brains aren't fully developed. And then the lawyer for the state says that juveniles are capable of foresight and that this felony murder rule should still be applied to juveniles because it helps prevent murders in the community.
Mm-hmm. So depending on what the high court says about this case, what might it mean for Keon Harrison?
It could mean that his first-degree murder conviction could get thrown out and then he could possibly get a new trial.
Okay. Katarina Sustarek, keeping us up to date on a couple of cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. Decisions expected when, Katarina?
Weeks or months from now.
Okay. We'll wait. Katarina Sustarek, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, this story, interesting. An Iowa high school class beats some incredible odds. All members of the high school class of 1957 are still alive. 6 decades after graduation, we'll talk with one of those graduates when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, entomologist Donald Lewis on the invasion of brown marmorated stink bugs. Ooh, I have them in my house. Perhaps you do, too. We'll find out about them in just a few minutes. Also, an Iowa class beats incredible odds to reach their 60th high school reunion. We'll talk to the vice president of that class of 1957. But first, a letter sent to numerous Iowa residents who legally immigrated from the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar has some of these residents and local refugee advocacy people worried about the U.S. government's intentions with regards to their legal status. Amy Steffen is with us. She's a reporter with the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on with us. Tell us, where did this letter come from? What did it say?
So the letter came from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And as far as we can tell, it came to about 10 Burmese refugees in Northeast Iowa and about 30 statewide so far. And basically, it seems to be a legitimate letter from the government that just asks them to come to what are termed voluntary meetings to help the government determine the validity of the information that they had already given the government when they immigrated over. Mm-hmm. But that if you decide not to come to the meetings, that it may possibly affect any sort of naturalization statuses that these people may have coming up.
And to be clear, these are residents of Iowa from Myanmar, but their legal status as refugees has already been approved, right?
That's correct in most cases. I think there's different levels of where they're at in the immigration status, but these are people that came here legally through different means.
Now, there's this group called EMBARC, Ethnic Minorities of Burma Advocacy and Resource Center. Some of the refugees have been turning to this group. What do they say about this letter? How people should react?
I talked to Alicia Sapi. She's the program director at EMBARC in Waterloo. And when they first started hearing about these letters a couple weeks ago, they weren't sure if they were legitimate. Some of them didn't come on official letterhead, which was confusing. And they were asking for people to come to meetings at different parts of the country, even in Indiana. So they started looking into this and determined that, like I said, by and large, they are legitimate. But basically that they're saying to them now that they've talked to their attorneys and different refugee groups, don't go to these meetings because they just don't know how information that these refugees give to the government after years or possibly even a decade since they gave original information to them may be construed or misconstrued.
Mm-hmm. Are there consequences for not showing up to these meetings?
They said that the meetings are voluntary, but EMBARC and other refugees are worried that because they may affect naturalization statuses, that it is very much a threatening letter to people. People that are going through these processes are already sort of worried that if they say the wrong thing now, maybe that stops.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting in your writing, too, you make note of the fact that there's about 2,000 refugees from Myanmar, mostly Burmese, that have fled. They have fled war and settled in eastern Iowa in the last decades, more statewide. So what are you looking at on this story going forward?
I would like to know if there's more letters that are going to be coming in, if people start attending the meetings, if there are consequences to these meetings, basically. And I think EMBARC's worried about that, too. They're sort of looking at this very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Amy, has anyone contacted the letter writers in Washington?
Yeah, the EMBARC has contacted them, and they've gotten a little bit of information. USCIS has also spoken a little bit to the media. They talked to the Des Moines Register and basically just said the investigation that they've been doing has raised concerns about identity and biographic information in a number of cases involving Burmese refugees, including many who have resettled in the U.S. So I think that was the impetus for some of these letters. But it's not clear if the people that were directly affected by the letters are the ones that they're looking at, or if it's more of a broader campaign to try to root that out.
Mm, interesting. Amy Steffen, thanks for telling us about that. Reporter with the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How many years has it been since your high school class graduated? 10, 20, 30, maybe 40? Well, how about 60? The Ringsted Iowa High School graduating class of 1957 is organizing their 60th reunion, and here's the amazing part. All of them are still alive, 6 decades after graduation from high school. Ringsted is a community in northwest Iowa. It's east of Spencer and Okoboji. Their 60th class reunion is happening in October. According to a statistician at Iowa State University named David Herzog, quoted in the Des Moines Register, that means the fact that they're all still alive means they've beaten the odds of 1 in 177 million. To give you an idea of what that means, it's higher odds than the chance of winning the Powerball. And the statistician says it's way less likely than an individual being struck by lightning twice in a lifetime, which, by the way, is a mere 1 in 9 million odds. Del Matheson is with us, was class vice president for the Ringsted Iowa High School graduating class of 1957. He joins me now from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Del Matheson.
Hello.
I just quoted those odds that was in the article of the Des Moines Register to start off with. Tell us, how many were in your graduating class back in 57?
Well, we started out as freshmen with 22, but in the 4 years of high school, six kids moved away to other high schools. You know, the farms were being purchased and becoming larger, so there were fewer kids. And then two of our classmates just gave up and quit school. And ironically, they're the two who died.
Mm.
But I don't think there's any connection. But we ended up with 14.
14.
We ended up with 14 happy, happy kids.
And these happy kids are grown adults, long since grown adults.
Yeah, we're the oldest teenagers in America.
When did you first become aware that all of you making it to 2018 was more than unusual, that it's incredible?
Well, when I was organizing the 45th reunion, which was held in a tavern in Ringsted, the tavern was the only place we could meet besides the high school building, and we ended up at the tavern and had a wonderful time. The it was then that I called an actuarial friend of mine, a former roommate after college, and he was with Aflac in Georgia at that time, and he said, "I can't believe it." He said, "You at 45 years out of high school, you haven't had a single death." I said, "Well, that's true. I have all their emails, and I phone them frequently, and I know they're alive." And he just laughed, and he said, "I'll figure out the odds of that sometime in the months to come." And so for 15 years, that's been a big thing for all of us, that we're still hanging in there, and we're still, you know.
Right, right. Well,
fun-loving people.
Well, being celebrated for still being alive is kind of morbid, isn't it?
Yeah, no. It is, but it's a happy thought.
It is, definitely. So tell us, 1957, a high school class in 1957, what are your fondest memories?
Well, being from a small town, we had to make big times out of the small times. You know, and we always had all-inclusive parties. When we planned a party, that meant that every one of us was invited, not just some of us.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few who were really anxious to get out of high school, but most of us were kind of, well, we'd loved high school. It was all important to us. We had the good fortune of attending a new high school building, which has since been demolished, torn down. But it was a beautiful high school building, and we were very proud to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, we had good athletic groups and good music groups. We had great teachers.
Mm-hmm. 60 years ago, of course, a much different world. Ike was president. I looked at some other information. 1957, the first Frisbee came out. The Russian satellite Sputnik started the space race. It was the peak baby boom year. The first nuclear reactor power plant opened in the U.S. Also, sadly, the era of segregation, whites-only drinking fountains and bathrooms. Your thoughts on when you think of the world today compared to that world in high school?
Well, it was a lot simpler. When you were reading those events, the thought when it kept going through my mind was, well, I read all about those in Weekly Reader. See, TV was still kind of new, and some of us didn't have TVs at home, so we relied upon the news from the radio and from news features in movie theaters every time we'd go to a movie, we'd see the current news on the screen, on the theater screen.
Right.
And also, we had the Weekly Reader, or Current Events. I think it was called Current Events.
Right. This is the little handout you got in school, right?
Yeah, right. Every week, our sociology class I could say, was forced to read the local news. I mean, not the local news, but the national news and international news. And it was a big thing for us because that's where we really learned how to read a newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the reunion is scheduled for October. How do you keep this class together? Are you kind of the linchpin? Can I call you that?
Well, or else the old Uncle Chicken who keeps the chicks together, you know.
The mother hen?
The mother hen. I don't mind being called a mother hen for this reason.
But we
keep closely in touch with one another. We're in Omaha, Dallas, Texas, Amarillo, Eugene, Oregon, various towns in Iowa and Minnesota, and that's, well, and two in Colorado. Two of us got married to one another, and Mike and Margo married each other and now live in Colorado City.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, we keep in touch. We keep track of each other.
Do you keep track of how many kids and grandkids belong to your class?
This is too good. This is just too good. We have 33 children, 74 grandchildren, and 28 great-grandchildren with one on the way. And that's more than we had in high school.
Many reasons to be grateful.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah.
Del Matheson, it's all the time we have now. It's been a real joy talking with you. Vice President of the Ringsted graduating class of 1957, six decades after graduating from high school in the northwest Iowa town of Ringsted. All of them, all 14, still alive, defying incredible odds. So, Del, when you do your 60th, you're arranging the 60th anniversary, the 60th reunion. You going back to the tavern in Ringsted for that?
We undoubtedly will have lunch there, but we're going to another town without any stoplights for our reception, and that's called Fenton. Fenton has a really nice little restaurant there called North Star, and we're going to take advantage of it. And they've got a side room where we can all meet in peace and joy and have a great ripping time.
Well, Del, I wish you and all your classmates many, many more class reunions to get together. I can imagine, just listening to you, you must have a ball together.
We do. We have a great time. It's just laughter from one end to the other.
Del Matheson, thanks very much for the conversation.
You bet.
Coming to the end of our News Buzz edition of River to River, I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, I found one overwintering in my window blinds just the other day. And if you've had this experience of touching one and then smelling your finger, you know it because, oh, it's an incredibly repulsive odor. They are called brown marmorated stink bugs. If your house is like mine, several of these little invaders have chosen your home to spend the winter. Brown marmorated stink bugs are invading everywhere, it turns out, decimating crops, infiltrating houses. A New Yorker article titled, "When 26,000 Stink Bugs Invade Your Home," is online. So we decided to find out more with Donald Lewis, entomologist at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Donald.
Hello, Ben. Good to be here.
Good to have you back. I've heard many names for these. Now I'm looking in one of the articles, Hummer of Insects. They do kind of look like a hummer. They're thick and sort of panzered, aren't they? The Devil's Thumbtack, another name for them. Who are these invaders?
Well, the brown marmorated stink bug is an insect that's becoming more and more well known, but it is another of our invasive species. These are insects that we didn't used to have. So if you think this is something new, you're right. It's only been in the United States since about 1996, 1998. We're not exactly sure when the first one arrived in Pennsylvania, but from there, they have moved with transport, and they have moved on their own, and our first ones were found in Iowa in 2011. So it's an insect that gets around, and it lives up to its name. It is brown. It is marmorated, which means it is marbled, kind of a mottled coloration on the back. It is a true bug, related to box elder bug and squash bug, and mm-hmm. they do stink.
Mm-hmm. They don't sting or bite, right?
They don't sting or bite. They don't have a stinger. They're not in that group of insects at all. Their mouth part is a little beak with which they penetrate plant tissues to feed on sap. So they're not a biting pest like some of the other insects, mosquitoes and so forth. But they do feed on plants by puncturing the plant and feeding on the sap. And that's what they do in the summer when they're growing and reproducing.
Okay, so that makes sense. It found them in my windowsill with our plants. So they found a place to hang out in the winter and puncture some of our plants.
Well, maybe. We've never really been able to document that they feed on houseplants. And remember, the ones that you find in the winter are in a state of dormancy. Our days are very short. They're probably not very hungry. They're just waiting for spring, hoping to be back outside by that time to feed on the plants and begin the process of reproduction. This is like multicolored Asian lady beetles and box elder bugs and attic flies and other insects that get into our house by accident. It's not to their advantage to be inside the house, but their natural instinct got them indoors back during September and October. And if you're finding them now, they have been in your house, possibly in the wall voids or in the attic, since last October, and just now they're warm enough to come out and make their presence known.
Oh, that stink, though, Donald. How would you describe it?
You know, I guess I'm a fortunate few that I don't think of them as all that stinky, but you mentioned finding several. In my house, I have found four, and that is over a span of 3 years' time. So you and I are talking about a very low number compared to the 24,000 that they claimed was in that house in New York. And we see these pictures from the East Coast of where tens of thousands of them will be on the side of the house, or there'll be dozens and dozens of them on the inside. I don't think anybody in Iowa has seen 24 of them inside yet. Not 24,000, just 24, because we have very low numbers compared to that. The general description is the brown marmorated stink bug smells like cilantro, which to some people is pretty repulsive, but to the rest of us, it makes our Mexican food enjoyable.
It sure does. So I'm not going to agree with the cilantro review of their stink.
Okay.
So are they a threat? I mean, it's pretty incredible that you and I and many listening have them in our house and they've been around, but they've only been here in Iowa since 2011. That's a few short years for them to be in every corner of Iowa, it seems.
Not quite every corner. We have been documenting the reports. That is, nobody is going out and looking for them, but as people contact the university, as people contact their local county extension office, we are keeping track, and they have been reported in 24 different counties. It's kind of a big triangle from Dubuque to Council Bluffs back to Burlington. If you draw a big triangle, that's where most of them are located. Now, if they're in those three points of the state along the rivers, they're probably in points in between, but they're either at very low levels, they're escaping detection, or nobody has reported them yet.
How much damage are they doing? How much of a threat are they?
Well, they are a threat to your emotional stability if you really, really hate stinky insects in your house.
Okay.
So far, no one has reported crop damage, but on the eastern half of the United States, over in Maryland and Virginia and so forth, they have so many stink bugs that it's causing damage to their crops, like apples and beans and so forth. Nobody has reported that in Iowa yet. So far to us, it's a household accidental invader, meaning it got into your house by accident. It can't feed. It can't reproduce inside your house. They drive you crazy. They're annoying, but they're not hurting you.
All right. And don't put them in Mexican food.
No. I don't think these would make good croutons. There are some insects that we can eat, but this is not one of them.
Donald Lewis, entomologist at Iowa State University. Thanks for the update on the brown marmorated stink bug in our homes and other places. Donald, thanks.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's have just enough time to groove into the weekend with IPR Studio One. Mark Simmet, host of Studio One Tracks. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben.
What do you have for for us this week?
This week's featured release on Tracks is the new one from MGMT, and it's called Little Dark Age.
And what is that a local band from this area?
This is a band that formed in Connecticut about 15 years ago. The prime members went to Wesleyan University, formed a band, and have been making music ever since. It's their first album in 5 years, and good enough to be our featured release this
week. Okay. Mark Simmet, host of Studio One Tracks. You can hear Tracks 7 days a week at 7 p.m. on Iowa Public Radio's Studio One. Of course, the Studio One stream available 24 hours a day at iowapublicradio.org. Let's listen to it going out. Thanks, Mark.
You bet.
Here it is, MGMT, Little Dark Age. The feature release this week on Studio One.
Breathing in the dark, lying on its side. The room.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help today also from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm hoping you're grooving into the weekend in nice fashion. Until Monday. Yeah.